You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across America, the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome to our program. And Mimi Marziani is with us. She is a counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, brennancenter.org. Mimi, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I've read now five stories from the New York Times to TPM to whatnot, you know, on your press release on what Judge Robert Simpson said this morning about the Pennsylvania voter suppression ID law is what I call it, but they call it voter ID laws. And I think I understand it, but I'm not really sure. And so I wanted somebody who really knows what they're talking about to come on here and inform our listeners and our viewers. Tell us what happened today.
Sure. And this has been a slightly unusual procedure. As I'm guessing many of your listeners know, Pennsylvania passed a very strict law requiring certain limited forms of photo identification before folks can vote in this year's election and elections to come. That was challenged, and plaintiffs claimed that it was unconstitutional under Pennsylvania's constitutional right to vote. And originally, the district court judge sided with the state, and he said, you know what, I have a lot of sympathy. I think that there will be a burden on some voters, but that burden on voters is not enough, in his opinion, to nullify the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a very disappointing ruling for, you know, those of us here at the Brennan Center and for advocates across the country.
So
plaintiffs appealed. It went to the state Supreme Court.
Right.
The state Supreme Court said, you know what, we don't think that the district court judge looked at this closely enough. And unless, you know, and we're going to send it back to him, he has to look at what the state is actually doing on the ground to see whether or not the state's doing enough to get IDs into the hands of every eligible voter who wants to cast a vote.
Right.
And so when it went back down to the trial judge looked at all the evidence and said, you know what, I'm not convinced that the state is actually going to be able to get IDs into everybody's hand before November. And so he has enjoined part of the law.
And didn't the trial judge even go a step beyond that and essentially say that if not the purpose, at least the outcome of this law would be voter disenfranchisement?
Yes. I mean, I want to be clear. I mean, the decision is qualified to some extent. He said that there would be disenfranchisement in this election,
right,
but not necessarily.
A couple of questions. First of all, this was the state Supreme Court, the state judge, were looking at the state of Pennsylvania's constitution, which guarantees the right to vote.
Yep.
In Bush v. Gore, correct me if I'm wrong, the U.S. Supreme Court said that at least with regard to electors for president of the United States, we have no constitutional right to vote at the federal level. Is that correct?
It is and it isn't. I mean, if you took out your handy constitution and read through it, which I urge actually everybody to do, it's a short document, it's worth reading, but there is no explicit right to vote the way that we all have an explicit right to speak freely.
Well, there are explicit rights to vote given to specific groups. The 13th Amendment gives it to African Americans, people who had previously been in servitude, actually, is the way I think the language. One of the 20-something, the right to vote is given to women. Later on, in what is it, 26th Amendment, the right to vote is given to 18-year-olds. So, but there's no, everybody has a right to vote, is there?
Right. It's a right to vote on equal footing with other citizens.
Right.
It's not a free
state. So the reason
that's
I ask this.
It's actually a big difference when you look at state constitutions, many of which actually explicitly guarantee a freestanding right to vote.
Well, the reason I ask that question is I'm wondering if there's any chance that this case is going to end up before the Supreme Court of the United States, or is it purely going to be decided based on the Constitution of Pennsylvania?
This case will be decided totally within Pennsylvania. I would have to look back at the original complaint to be 100% certain, but I believe that it was brought wholly under the Pennsylvania state constitution. And actually, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has the final say on matters of Pennsylvania law. The U.S. Supreme Court can't jump in.
Okay. Except in the case of things like Bush v. Gore.
Well, that involved the federal constitution. So unless the plaintiffs have raised that claim, this will stay squarely in Pennsylvania.
Right. Okay. And then the second question, correct me if I'm wrong, but my read of this is that a poll worker can say to somebody who shows up at the polls in November in Pennsylvania, may I see your identification, please? And in fact, the word can be spread down the line. In fact, a voter suppression group could even put up a sign at a certain distance in the polling place saying, you will be asked for your ID. And they can ask for the ID, but the voter can also say, no, I'm not going to show you. And they still have to be allowed to vote like a normal voter. Doesn't this set up a situation where groups that are aggressively trying to engage in voter suppression still have carte blanche?
I mean, I'm not sure I would go that far. I mean, this is still a significant victory for those of us who want to encourage voting.
Right.
However, the system that you just correctly described will, we fear, lead to a fair amount of voter confusion. And it could be, you know, it could also lead to abuse, but I actually think that our biggest concern is that voters are going to be confused. You know, there's been a lot of media coverage. People maybe, you know, then they're asked for an ID and they don't actually know whether or not they have to show that ID. And unless poll workers are well trained and the state doesn't have very much time to do that, we could have a situation where there's a lot of misinformation and that's causing problems both from the voter's point of view because they don't know their rights and they don't know the state of the law, but then also possibly from the poll worker's point of view if they're not properly trained.
Well, the reason I ask is in part, you know, what we're seeing right now, and also a decade or so ago another book I was writing, I read a biography of Chief Justice Rehnquist.
Mm-hmm.
And he made his way in the Republican Party in the late 50s, early 60s, if I recall the time frame right, it might have been the mid-60s, in Arizona, standing outside the polling places in Native American districts and Hispanic districts, and he's a very tall man. He was like 6'1 or 6'2 and very imposing figure back then.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just a lawyer at that time. Loudly demanding to see people's identification and challenging their right to vote, even though Arizona law didn't require any kind of voter ID, he was asserting it, and he would get, you know, on a good day, a third of the people to simply leave the line because they didn't want to put up with his harassment. And this is not an uncommon tactic. I mean, this has been going on for a long, long time.
Sure. And we do know, actually, there are large groups of people in our country organized rather loosely under a group called True the Vote that have been, quote-unquote, training volunteers.
Yeah, they're trying to get a million Rehnquists out there.
Yeah, to actually go out and challenge voters. As you can surely recognize, asking somebody for ID is just one tactic. Unfortunately, and it changes from state to state, but there are, under the laws of many states, several grounds on which an aggressive challenger, you know, can challenge somebody's eligibility to vote. And you're exactly right that it can be extremely intimidating.
Right. Okay. So we'll see how this plays out on Election Day, right? There's not going to be any further appeals between now and then?
I think it is highly unlikely. I think we're out of time.
Okay. All right. And we are for the segment, too. Perfect timing. Mimi Marziani, thank you. Counsel with the Democracy Program for the Brennan Center for Justice. BrennanCenter.org is the website. Mimi, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you. We will be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, how many voters, how many states, how many places will the Republicans succeed in getting people to not vote? We'll see. Steal away with an election? Is that the deal? Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Mr. Scalia was wrong. Congressman Ted Deutsch is on the line with us. Deutsch.house.gov. He represents the 19th District of Florida. And, Congressman, welcome back to the program, first of all.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be with you again.
Thank you for joining us. And I understand that this scandal that is unfolding in your state with this this company that for apparently more than a decade has been involved in election fraud as opposed to voter fraud in various places. I know that they got busted, or at least suggested that they were busted. They were outed in the local news media back when I was living in Portland 4 years ago in the last election. Tell me what's going on in your state and what you're proposing to do about it.
Sure. I'm happy to do it, Tom. And the important thing to note here is it's not just going on in Florida,
right?
But, and I think this is really just the tip of the iceberg. Here's what's happening. The Florida Republican Party, it retained this company, Strategic Ally Consulting. Strategic Ally Consulting, then went out to engage in voter registration drives all throughout the state. There is something of a sordid history with this company, as you alluded to. But there, we've now learned just in the past few days that in Palm Beach County alone, there are over 106 cases of likely fraudulent activities where there are voter registration forms that were turned in where the signatures didn't match, where they had business addresses, where they changed registrations from Democrat to Republican, all sorts of things that are illegal under Florida law. They're illegal under every state law. Mm-hmm. And so these were discovered, and what's happened since is interesting. On the one hand, you had the Republican Party say that this is really just one bad guy. He doesn't really represent all the people that we engaged to do this. But they then turn around and fire the company in Florida and the $1.3 million they were being paid here. And they fired this company in all of the other swing states where they had been retained and where they're being paid more than $3 million by the RNC and by the Romney campaign. So we now know of a problem in Palm Beach County. There are 10 other counties in Florida where there appear to be also just one guy or more. And I reached out to the governor and told him, Tom, as you know, Governor Scott in Florida spent months on this voter purge trying to suppress the vote by kicking tens of thousands of eligible voters off of our rolls. Right? He spent all this time combating illusionary voter fraud. Now he's got cases of real voter fraud, and he has just remained silent. And we sent him a letter to tell him that he's got to get out there and he's got to do something about it.
Yeah. And yesterday we had BBC investigative reporter Greg Palast on this program. He said that the Governor Scott, or the Secretary of State in Florida, has already succeeded in the last few months in knocking 60,000 to 80,000 people off the voting rolls. And the one thing that they all have in common is that they have BLA after their name on the voter registration. In other words, they're African Americans. This is, you know, shades of 2000 that it's happening all over again. But that's not what you're calling. You're calling for an investigation, a bipartisan investigation into this GOP voter registration fraud scandal.
Right. And I think not surprisingly, I've received a really positive response from Republicans around the state, too. I told the governor that he needs, for someone who has been perceived to be nakedly partisan in so much of what he does, that in order to ensure, just 30 days out from an election, that we do everything we can to uphold the integrity of the election, he needs to appoint a bipartisan panel to get together to figure out what we can do to help the supervisors of elections go out and do their job, make sure that voter fraud isn't being committed, make sure that people who are eligible to vote don't lose that right. There's an awful lot that they can do, but we need to get it done. We can't wait around. Because before you know it, the election will have come and gone.
Right. Well, and a lot of these, this voter suppression campaign, some of these laws in some of these states came out of the American Legislative Exchange Council. Here's the founder of the American Legislative Exchange Council, Paul Weyrich. He was also the co-founder of the Heritage Foundation. Back in 1980, when he was working on the Reagan campaign, speaking to a group of Christian Republican activists in Dallas, Texas. This is just a 20-second clip. I wanted you to hear it.
How many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome? Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
This is the father of ALEC and of the Heritage Foundation. So, and helped run the Reagan campaign and both Bush campaigns. So,
Listen, it's outrageous. That is an outrageous clip. The idea that anyone would actually say that we don't want more people to vote. We want fewer people to vote. We want to control who votes. We want to limit access to the polls. That anybody could say anything like that in the United States of America is appalling. But if you look just at the way Governor Scott has approached this issue in Florida and his efforts to kick thousands of voters off of the rolls. And remember, just a few months ago, he had this list of 182,000 names that he rolled out, Tom, and he said, these people we suspect may be illegal citizens, illegal immigrants. They don't have the right to vote, and they should be purged from our rolls. Right. What did we find? Well, we found that list included, among other things, a decorated World War II hero, small business owners, lots and lots of eligible voters who tended to skew, not surprisingly, Democratic, who have seen their right to vote stripped away from them. Well, we beat the governor on that. He's retreated on that. And now we're doing everything we can to make sure that he's not able to run away from this issue.
Well, good on you for this, and I wish you the very best with getting Congress to investigate this. Congressman Ted Deutsch, thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thanks. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts on it, your thoughts on it, right after this. Tom Hartman with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Boy, a lot going on. I mean, just a lot going on. Pennsylvania's up in the air. The debates are tomorrow. It's like, you know, the Pennsylvania actually says, well, the state Supreme Court says you have a right to vote. The federal Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, SCOTUS, not so much. You don't have a right to vote. So some states will be able to have voter suppression ID laws, other states not. I love playing that Paul Weyrich clip for Democratic members of Congress who have not heard it before. It never fails to produce a what response. Ed in Plymouth Falls, Oregon?
Klamath,
that's what I thought. Hey, Ed, how you doing?
Okay. Tom, has anyone like ACLU or anybody ever thought to go after the voting thing as a right to free speech? I mean, that is like the most fundamental free speech a person can have. It's my right and 100 million other people's right to say who we want to run our country. Not only that, there's the question of the referendums that are on the ballot. Now, sometimes I get taxed, a little tax for the library or something.
Right.
If I don't get a chance to talk about whether I want to be taxed for the library under 10 or 20 cents per hundred on my taxes, then they've taken away, that's the equivalent of taxation without representation. And I think Jefferson and the other people had some strong opinions about that in America, as I recall.
Well, Jefferson was actually a fan of supporting libraries. But that said, I mean, not necessarily at the federal level, but at the community level. But that said, the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no laws restricting freedom of speech.
Well, voting is a method of speech.
Right, but Congress has not made any laws requiring ID. These have all been made at the state level. And it doesn't say that no law shall exist, or it doesn't say that, you know, I mean, you know, and it, like I believe the Establishment Clause it's referred to as, Shano can correct me if I'm wrong here, that says that, you know, there shall be no test, no religious test for somebody, you know, running for public office. You could argue that applies throughout the United States. It doesn't say, you know, Congress cannot pass a law. It says there shall not be, if I'm recalling my Constitution correctly. I'd have to go back and look at it. Am I right on that? Who knows? Okay. All right. Close it up.
What about the taxation idea then? The referendum and whatnot.
Yeah. So you're suggesting that we should be arguing, or that it could be argued, that the right to vote is the right to free speech.
Absolutely.
And, And, okay. Let me ponder that. Let me ponder that. Ed, I think you may be onto something. Thank you very much for that, and thanks for the call. Lee in Duval, Washington. Hey, Lee, thanks for listening to Talk 1090. What's up?
Hello, Tom. I have to get you off speakerphone.
Sure.
I agree with you that it's election fraud, not voter fraud, is the problem. What's kind of people are missing the point is the problem with our voting system is apathy. It's not that people think their vote counts so much that they're willing to cheat. I think it's just amazing that, you know, two or three people here or there across the country think that their vote, and I mean, it's good that they do. It's good that people think their vote counts, because it should. But that the Republicans claiming that, it's kind of they're missing the whole point.
Right. Well, you know, they're basically saying, you know, the earth may be struck by, actually has been a couple of times been struck by meteors. So let's just, you know, shut down all life on earth, because eventually, you know, we could go the way of the dinosaurs if we get hit. It's a lousy metaphor or analogy, but it's just it's such overkill. It's like, hey, there's a fly in the house. Get out the 12 gauge and go after it.
And it's apathy was what the problem is. It's not that there people actually think their vote is counting. And we should all think that our vote counts. The other thing I think I'd like to see Obama do on this debate is talk about the Republicans always trying to dodge taxes. Mm. We spend over 51% of every tax dollar on the military. I thought the Republicans were strong on the military. If they're dodging taxes, they're dodging support for the military. Am I right?
Yeah. And Romney has, you know, based his wealth on not just dodging taxes, but using offshore vehicles to dodge taxes. I mean, this is part of Bain Capital's business model. And
have a good day.
Yeah, thank you very much. And it's becoming increasingly obvious. Dan in Chicago, listening to WCPT.
Hi.
Hey, Dan, what's up?
I just can't understand why we don't need IDs to vote. It just doesn't make any sense.
Because the harm does not outweigh the risk.
Well, I was in a federal courthouse last week, and I needed an ID to get in.
Because the harm that you could cause in that federal courthouse would outweigh the risk that you could represent in that federal courthouse, at least in this post 9/11 era, outweighs the harm done to you by asking for ID. So, you know,
okay,
we always look at these.
So what harm
risks
was I causing yesterday at Walgreens when I went in for their clinic for the ID, not for an ID, for a sinus infection, and they required an ID. Now, what harm was I causing there?
The potential harm to Walgreens was that you could sue them for you know, treating you inappropriately, and you know, and they would have no record of it. They wouldn't know who you were and what happened. So they
need an ID.
So the consequence of that potential harm to them, which is substantial, is asking for an ID. Now here's the question.
If
George W. Bush successfully spent $74 million and 7 years urging his federal prosecutors to find people who had illegally voted, And they literally spent $74 million in 7 years looking for these people. It so clogged up the federal prosecutor's offices that seven attorneys, you know, quit over this issue. You'll recall in the last year of the Bush administration, it was a huge scandal, and they were unable to find it. Rick Scott down in Florida spent some $20 million of his state's money looking for illegal voters. He found one guy. A guy from Austria who had become a Canadian citizen, who moved to Florida and lied about his U.S. citizenship, which didn't exist, in order to get a concealed carry permit and in order to buy a whole bunch of guns. And then he thought, hey, what the hell? He could use that ID to vote. And he voted in the 2004 and 2008 elections. That one guy. So the question, if you have a situation where the harm that would be done is that as many as 10 million U.S. citizens may be disenfranchised. A quarter of African Americans don't have the ID necessary to vote. About 19% of all.
Well, they can't go to Walgreens to get better either, can they?
That's correct.
They can't go to a federal
That's correct.
Can they?
That's correct.
Well, is
that's correct.
Wrong?
And they're not
they
trying
to.
And they're not trying
to.
These. Listen. Let me finish this point. It's a very simple, very straightforward thing. You've got people who are never going to try and walk into a federal courthouse, who are never going to go to Walgreens and say, you know, look in my ear infection, or they may go to a free clinic where they're not asking for their ID, who are poor, who are living in urban environments, who don't own cars, who live in big cities, people who are elderly, who no longer drive. You've got about 20% of the over 65 population no longer has ID that would allow them to vote. You've got about 18 to 19%, as I recall, of people 18 to 24, college age, who are, you know, still living with their parents or they're living on campus or whatever. They don't own a car. They've never gotten a driver's license. When you look
in
at the demographics of these things,
who are voting.
These are the groups who skew Democratic. These are the groups who tend to skew Democratic. You look at white males, the Republican voter primary demographic, it's 7% don't have appropriate ID. So you tell me that this isn't an attempt to suppress the vote.
No, but you're suppressing speech right now, too.
Why? Because you tried to talk over me and I kept talking?
Yeah, because you wouldn't let me get a word in edgewise.
I finished my sentence and I paused.
You realize in the city of Chicago, they print up ballots in 40 different languages?
That's not what we're talking about. I don't disagree with you that English. Listen, Dan, if you want to change the topic to should English be the official language of the United States,
I
will agree with you.
You didn't hear me say that, did you? You're just interpreting what you want to interpret.
What does the ballot being printed in 40 different languages have to do with disenfranchising elderly people who can't get out of the house to go to the DMV and get an ID?
And do everything you need an ID. But you're going to let people...
No, there's a lot of things you can do without an ID. You can live in the United States without an ID. Dan, it was conservatives and Republicans here in the United States. Dan, listen to me for a minute. Listen to this. Dan, okay, Dan, just... listen to this for a moment, and then you can respond. It was Republicans and conservatives who went hysterical when Bill Clinton proposed national ID standards. Why are you guys all in favor of ID now?
Don't say you guys. Don't say you guys. The greatest Republican president probably was...
Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, I wasn't thinking of that. I was thinking more of Garfield, but...
Or maybe Abraham Lincoln.
More aligns with your thinking, too, I would think.
Yeah, but nonetheless, my point is that it was Republicans and conservatives when Bill Clinton said maybe we should all have a national ID so we all know who we are. And, you know, it can be used and you can move state to state. You could use it to vote. You could use it for all kinds of things. Republicans said, oh, no, we're not going to have a national ID. You know what comes after that? FEMA camps.
Okay.
I'm serious. I'm not making this up. Go back and look at the, you know, you had Michelle Bachmann hysterical about this stuff. And
I could care less about Michelle Bachmann. I could care less about
or at least
ID.
Her type. I mean,
I do think you should have a state ID in order to vote.
I don't think so.
That's only makes sense.
You do have to show ID when you register to vote. You have to show, you know, some evidence that you live where you are saying that you live. In most states, in many states, you have to show more than that. But you have to demonstrate that you're legally a resident there. And in many states, you have to demonstrate that you're a citizen. But not every time you vote. When you vote, they compare your signature to your initial registration. And if your signature doesn't compare with your initial registration, they don't let you vote. And we've done that in every state in the union for forever. I mean, you know, for a long, long time. This is a problem. This is a problem that doesn't exist. You guys are trying to, what you're offering is a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. But by the way, we'll kick about a quarter of Democratic voters off the rolls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And as Paul Weyrich said, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down. Back to Talk Media for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you. Francis Causey on the line with us. Heist dash. You all know what heist means, right? Heist. H-E-I-S-T. Heist-themovie.com is the website for this really, really, really cool movie that is opening nationwide. Francis Causey, the co-producer, co-director and producer of Heist. Francis, welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's great to be back with you. It's an exciting day for us here at Heist, and you're very modest, but you're the narrator of the film and incredibly good in the movie, and it's an important day for us. So I'm really happy to be here.
Well, thank you. Tell us, you know, what is happening? How is this rollout happening? What do people need to know about this?
Well, two things. I mean, there are two premieres today, actually, on Link TV. Heist will have its world premiere on Link TV. It's 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 o'clock Eastern.
Mm-hmm.
You can catch it on your satellite systems. I think it's some terrestrial also.
Right.
And then we're having a live streaming event at snagfilms.com. And it's going to be a really exciting studio show in Lower Manhattan. David K. Johnston, who's one of the great experts in the film, is going to mm-hmm. be in studio, and Donald and I will be joining them later tonight to answer questions from both the live studio audience and people asking questions from the streaming event. So if you go to snagfilms.com, you can find out more about that.
SNAG, like reach out and snag something films?
Exactly.
Okay, snagfilms.com.
Yep. And then you could always go to heist-themovie.com to also get connected.
Right. And the essence of the movie, why the title Heist? What's this movie about for our, you know, as you said, I narrated it, I'm familiar with it, but for our listeners and viewers who don't know what you're talking about.
Sure, I mean, over the last 40 years, what we've seen is a deliberate transfer of wealth from the poor and middle class in our country to the very wealthiest. And what we do is really we connect the dots of that crime that started in 1971 with the Powell memo, which was kind of inspirational to some wealthy folks, and they took the memo and implemented it through policy think tanks, and of course created the system of lobbying we know. So it's the heist is really a death by a thousand cuts to the middle class, and it everything from going from defined pensions to 401k to how our political system has become so corrupt with money, and how this impacts people's pocketbooks. How it really has, one of the features of the American dream has always been this upwardly mobile. I'll do better than my parents. My kids will do better than me. And we really take a look at that and see, what's happened over the last 40 years.
Yeah. The point I think that's so important to make is here we are, the wealthiest nation in the world. And we've got politicians running around with their hair on fire saying, we're broke. The money's all gone. And as a matter of fact, you know, some $5+ trillion did vanish out of the pockets, out of the home values, out of the pensions and savings accounts of the middle class over the last decade. But in addition to that, we've been robbed. I mean, basically, that's what's gone on. There's been this heist. We've been robbed.
Exactly. I mean, you look at, for instance, how wages have stagnated, a lot of the headlines, if you really, our film is about the nuances, the backstory behind the headlines that in most cases, it's just flat out not true. It's agenda. Like there's so much more nuance and perspective, if you will, that people need to understand about the budget. But they punch these hot button issues to get people all fired up. And what we try to do, for instance, is show that, say, wages have stagnated since the mid-70s. And of course, people, once money became cheap through the banks, I mean, people had to borrow to pay for things like groceries and medical, care.
Right.
But yet all you hear is about how, 47% of us are on the dole and we're shiftless and not working and we really connect the dots of that story. I mean, this has been one of the big problems of corporate consolidated news media, which we also go into. They're not really telling in a shorter format. Fortunately, you have a longer format so you can deal with it, but do so very well. But people need to understand that that what's happened has been this kind of deliberate assault on working people and wages. I mean, I know I've been in corporate situations where I felt like I was a line item in a budget.
Sure.
And we tell that whole big story from kind of start to finish, which was challenging, but it took us six years, but we did it.
Right. Yeah, this the story of the heist of the wealth of the American middle class and the transfer upward to the Romney class, basically.
Right. And what people people need to understand, I think, is this was deliberate. This was a planned, orchestrated event by very disciplined people implementing, staying on message, you know, just with one thing in mind. Greed is good. Of course, it all consolidated under Ronald Reagan. I mean, it, you know, everything was kind of happening with deregulation beginning in the 1970s, and Carter went along in many ways. And then by the time Reagan comes into office, it's just they've got the machine in place. And, you know, I think, honestly, since then, it's just been kind of reaping the spoils because you see a lot of Democratic cooperation from the Democratic Party with these Republican free market, you know, extremism, idealism. The market always knows best. And in reality, you know, as one of our guests in the movie says, you know, markets are based on laws, and it's a question of who the law benefits. And I think we're pretty clear. The evidence is unbelievably strong that this even 0.1%, 0.2% of people have benefited mostly. I think in the last year or so, 93% of income gains have gone to the 1%.
Yep. It is as Elizabeth Warren said at the DNC, the game is rigged, and it's been rigged in behalf of the Romney class for some time. The movie is heist-themovie.com is the website. Francis Causey, the co-director and producer. Thank you, Francis.
Thanks, Tom.
Be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And stories out about Mitt Romney back when he was a bishop in the Mormon Church, counseling a woman to basically leave the church if she was going to leave her husband. Why? Because this is Mormon law. Just like, you know, if you went to a Catholic priest under canonical law, there's a certain set of rules that you conduct yourself by, just like Orthodox Jews, under kosher laws and halacha, don't wear clothing made of two different kinds of fabric, don't eat shellfish, things like that. What about Muslim law? What about Sharia law? Dr. Ander Bostom is with us. AnderBostom.org is the website, associate professor of medicine at Brown University. And welcome to the program, first of all, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. I understand you are quite frightened by or concerned about Sharia law, the Muslim variation of canonical law and Mormon law and Jewish law. I'm assuming there are variations for Buddhists and for Hindus as well.
I think that first we have to define Sharia to understand it, and we have to see what the domestic and international Islamic agendas are now openly converging. And then we can see what existing mainstream Islamic institutions and their ongoing efforts in North America are doing to facilitate what's really an international form of law.
Are you suggesting, before you go any further, are you suggesting that there is A, as in one Muslim agenda?
One Muslim agenda? There's a body of law. It's a very specific body of law. It's totalitarian in the general sense of all-encompassing, regulating everything from ritual aspects of religion to personal hygiene to the governance of an Islamic state or block of states or a global Islamic order.
Are you familiar with the latter
political aspect that's the most troubling and is really in many respects an ancient antecedent, a more familiar modern totalitarian system. So specifically, Sharia's liberty-crushing and dehumanizing political aspects feature such things as open-ended jihadism to subjugate the world to a totalitarian Islamic order.
I'm not buying it.
Rejection of bedrock Western.
I'm not buying it. But let me go back to my original question to you.
Wait a minute. If we cannot explain,
if you're going to try and filibuster this,
then you're wasting my time. I really don't want to have my time wasted.
Well, that's.
If you want to understand what it is, then
I would like to. I'm trying to understand your worldview. I know that if I were to go to a Muslim...
I guess we'll have to stop.
Will you let me speak once in a while here? Oh, he hung up. Okay. Well, here's my question I was going to ask. If I went to a Muslim country and I said, let me tell you the Christian worldview, I think that they would look at me and go, what, are you crazy? We got one story from the Catholics, we got another story from the Protestants, we got a different story from the Seventh-day Adventists, we got a different story from the Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, you've got Sharia, you've got Sunnis, you've got Shiites. They don't like each other. In fact, they kill each other. In fact, you know, the Sunnis in Iraq fought a war with the Shia in Iran for 10 years, and over a million people on both sides died. We, by the way, were funding both sides. We were providing intelligence to the Iranians, and we were providing weapons to the Iraqis. But it's unfortunate. In any case, if you'd like to learn more about our guest who just bailed on us, you can check out his website, Andrew Bostom, BOSTOM.org. And I guess we'll leave it at that. Let me just share with you some things, some of the interesting things that we found when we were researching this topic. Sharia, first of all, is a process. It's not a law. There's not a law that you can point to that says this is Sharia. Much like going before, like a Catholic couple coming to a priest and saying, you know, we'd like counseling, or, you know, how should we conduct ourselves with regard to this? Or a Jewish couple going to their rabbi, or and as I said, I'm sure this is true of every major religion in the world, or a Mormon couple going to their bishop, going to Mitt Romney and saying, you know, okay, the woman saying, you know, I'm going to divorce my husband. He's been running around. He ain't no good. And the Mormon position on that is, well, if you divorce your husband, you have to leave the church. You are an outcast. Or at least that's apparently what he said. So these are process things. This is not like, you know, in some places there are things that are defined. You know, Catholic law has this canon law is called. For example, Canon 1083. This is Catholic law worldwide. The minimum marriage age for girls is 14. Now, that was changed in 1983, by the way. It was 12 up until 1983, and now it's 14. That's official Catholic doctrine. Now, does that mean that we should be running around the world going, look at these barbarians, we need to outlaw Catholicism, come on. I mean, that would be absurd. And to say, oh, and therefore we're not going to allow Catholics to go to get counseling or to have their disputes adjudicated by their parish priest or by, you know, somebody who and pardon me if you're Catholic and I'm using my language imprecisely. I did not grow up Catholic, and so I'm not. I could tell you the Methodist take on this, which is not all that different. But it's like, would we say that? No, of course not. Are the Catholics trying to convert every single person on earth to Catholicism? Of course they are. The Catholic Church proudly issued a press release 2 years ago. We covered it on this program. We had somebody from the Catholic Church on the program. Proudly issued a press release saying that they had passed, as I recall, it was a billion. It might have been a billion and a half, but I think it was a billion people who are now Catholic. There's about a billion and a half Muslims in the world, maybe more. But that's just, you know, and Catholicism is just part of Christianity. Does that mean that, oh, my God, they're coming to get us? No. I don't understand the fear and hysteria that comes along with people like my friend David Horowitz, who's been on this program many times, and we've debated this issue many, many times, and he's very, very freaked out that the Muslims are coming to get him. I just don't get it. And apparently the same with this fellow from Brown University, School of Medicine. Is that to say that, you know, in the Orthodox Jewish communities where people, a married couple, can't sleep together in the same room when the woman is menstruating, that's freedom crushing? Well, you know, there's probably some women who would think it is, and probably some men who would think it is. But if people choose to live by a set of religious rules, if people choose to submit themselves to those, and the word Islam means submission, if people choose to submit themselves, whether it is kosher laws, whether it is canonical law, whether it is Mormon law, whether it is Seventh-day Adventist law, whether it's Jehovah's Witness law, whether it's, you know, whatever religious laws that you as a community, as long as they don't come into conflict with the laws of the nation, I don't think we should have as a nation a problem with it. And in fact, I believe that our Constitution prohibits us from having a problem with it. The First Amendment. Congress shall pass no laws that would infringe on freedom of religion. Now, does that mean that 12-year-olds or 14-year-olds, rather, can get married in the United States simply by declaring that they're Catholics? Because, they, you know, Canon 1083 of the Catholic Church says that 14 is the age of consent for marriage for girls worldwide? No. The law of the nation supersedes that. So it's just... And by the way, I mean, there's this, you'll find similar. The reason I use that is because one of the things that's most often thrown out about, oh, Sharia law allows, you know, 10-year-old girls to get married. Well, or to be committed to marriage. Arranged marriages you will find in every culture around the world. But, you know, is that a reason to say, let's pass a law against Sharia law? No.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So anyway, I thought we'd have an interesting conversation about Sharia law, but apparently not. You're welcome to talk with me about it, and, you know, what's going on in Pennsylvania and the voter suppression.
Look at you, compared to America, you're in space.
Okay, Mitt Romney got rich with a very, very specific business model, and that business model was harvesting the wealth of companies. Very often harvesting the paychecks of the employees, the pensions, the benefits, whatever, you know. And one of those companies that's being harvested right now is a company called Sensata. And Tom Gulrap is on the line. Do I have your name right, Tom?
Yes, that's right, Tom.
And Bainport.com is the website for what?
We're doing an encampment across the street from the plant in the Stevenson County Fairgrounds.
Right.
We're on day 21 today, so we're camping out and inviting all of our friends and supporters to come over and join with us.
Okay.
And show how everybody feels about outsourcing of good American jobs.
So let's tell the backstory here, Tom. How did you come to this situation? What's going on there? Just tell our viewers and listeners, you know, what's going on.
Okay, it started in January. It started in October of 2010 when Honeywell, that we had worked for, announced that they were selling their automotive sensors division to a company called Sensata Technologies.
Okay.
And Sensata Technologies actually took it over the last day of January of 2011. They called everybody together, and they said, this is our transition team. They introduced two or three people. And then the next bullet on their agenda was, by the end of 2012, all the jobs in this plant will be moved to China.
Wow.
So
how many jobs was that?
About 170 jobs.
And these were decent? Yeah, this was not like Staples jobs where you make $8 an hour. These were actually decent jobs?
These very well-paying, highly technical manufacturing jobs. And this Sensata Technologies had set a record last year, actually, for profitability. So it's not like they needed to move it or they would go bankrupt. It
right.
was purely... agreed situation, and it's just a situation where the balance between profitability and community responsibility that you used to see with businesses is right. completely out the window now, and they will do anything to get another dollar.
So Bain came to you guys and said, we are sending your jobs to China. I understand that they also asked you to train the people from the Chinese people who are going to replace you.
Yeah, they actually brought in their engineering staff who has to learn the equipment and then go back to China and train the individual employees.
Wow.
they were there for about 10 weeks. They paid attention for about two. So they don't really have a clue as to what is going on with this equipment, and they won't see it again until it gets there.
So they're literally packing your factory up and shipping it to China?
They actually are. Today they brought in some big metal container trucks to load equipment in. So we saw them bringing those in at 6 o'clock in the morning, so we got our community supporters, of which there are many, many, and we went over to the plant and we blocked, well, the community supporters blocked the trucks from getting in, and we were there from about 7 o'clock until after 2 o'clock and didn't allow a single vehicle to get in there.
Right.
And then the police came and told us we had to leave and let the trucks go through. So we peaceably withdrew to our camp across the street from the plant, and we're regrouping there and ready for our next section.
We're talking with Tom Gulrap. Bainport.com is the website. Bainport is the basically you're occupying across the street from the Sensata plant in Freeport.
Yes, that's right. We have community supporters that are bringing us food. They've provided us with tents and just
winter's coming.
All kinds of stuff. Firewood, because it's getting cold.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an amazing experience because you get to see people of all ages and, you know, genders who are there, who are pitching in to help us to get the word out that outsourcing of American jobs is absolutely the wrong thing.
Right.
And there is no good reason for it.
Yeah. And of course, this is the Bain Capital. This is part of their business model as envisioned by the guy who was at one point in time the sole stockholder and president and founder of Bain Capital, Mitt Romney. Bainport.com is the website. This plant is being closed by Bain in Freeport, Illinois. Illinois is a pretty progressive state. You've got some great representation. You've got a very progressive governor. I'm guessing, Tom, that you guys have looked into all the possible legal ways to prevent this from happening, and that, you know, they've rigged the system.
They really have. You know, so it's not illegal, but it's as unethical as can possibly be.
Right.
Because they're destroying the American dream of these families. You know, we should be out looking for early Christmas presents for people at this time of the year. Instead, we're trying to figure out how we're going to make our mortgage payments in December.
Wow. This is going to be a tough one. And your jobs are now all gone, or are they about to go?
They're about to go. Some of them are already gone. Personally, my job is scheduled for my last day is November 5th, amazingly enough, the day before the election.
Wow.
So I like to tell people that after I go vote on the 6th, I will go sign up for unemployment compensation for the first time in my life after 33 years in that plant.
Wow. And also that the investors at Bain Capital can make more money that, by the way, they pay a maximum 15% income tax rate on, whereas you guys working at the plant could pay up as much as 35% because you actually work for a living.
Yes, we do.
Tom Gulrap, an employee at the Sensata plant in Freeport, Illinois, being closed by Bain right now and being occupied from Bainport right across the street, bainport.com. Check it out. Tom, thank you for being with us, and good luck in your
future. Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You know, for folks like Mitt Romney, it's just like, hey, you know, it's numbers on a spreadsheet. But for people like Tom Gulrap, it's his life. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And should we be hysterical and frightened about Sharia law? Or should we, frankly, be more frightened about Bain Capital coming around? I would submit to you that more lives of more Americans have been destroyed by Bain Capital than have been destroyed by by Sharia law. Who knows? Actually, I think I could probably make that statement. Henry in Dixon, Illinois. Hey, Henry, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? Hope you're having a good day today.
Thank you. I am.
Look here, some of these people calling in, and they got the right idea as for voter suppression and things like that. But the key thing that makes it that much harder, the reason why it's really illegal if you think about it, they done shut down almost 25% to 30% of some of the registration places that you go to get your ID.
Right.
So it's not like the people got, to go around the corner like they used to get the ID, because every other neighborhood had a facility that a person was able to go to, get their license or ID or state ID, and go on by their business. But they shut those down. Now the people got to drive across town in the rural areas to get an ID. Now what sense does it make for a person to be almost downtown Philadelphia and have to go all the way to the northern suburbs just to get a doggone ID?
Right.
And he has no car. He used public transportation. And he has other responsibilities to do.
Right.
All
and
you're doing is making it that much harder for that person to vote. So how in the world are you going to get on radio or television or wherever and sit up there talking about, well, I got an ID, what about this? Well, you're in a different situation.
Right. And not only that, I mean, Louise and I took a walk last weekend on Saturday. And on Saturday, the driver's license places here in D.C. are open. And there's one about, 6-8 blocks from where we live. And we walked by it, and there was this long line snaking out. Now, you don't have to have a driver's license in order to vote in Washington, D.C., but you do have to have a driver's license to drive. And it just hit me. I mean, in fact, we actually walked up to the line and said, what kind of ID have the ID requirements changed recently? Wondering if the Republicans had gotten to D.C. And
right.
But we couldn't find anybody who could tell us. Basically, what they said was you have to stand in line and wait until you get to the front of the line and then ask what kind of ID you need to bring with you to get your ID. And that is going to be about a 3-hour wait.
Yeah,
so it's like, really?
This has always been my problem when people keep talking about cut the government, cut the government, cut the government. One, when you cut the government, you're cutting jobs. Two, you're making it that much harder for people to do their job because you put that much more work on them to try to get the same results as you would having, say, you got a section that got 50 people, you cut it down to 20, but then people who are in 20 got to come up with the same results as people with 50.
Right.
And that's hard to do. And that's why I said, when these people talk utterly crazy, talking about, well, let's reduce the government. No, the government actually need to be at a proportion size to be able to facilitate all the needs for the people.
Yeah.
And if the government can't, facilitate all the needs for the people, then what's the point of even having it around? Because all you're doing is you just have
a answer. Henry, I'm with you. You sold me. And, in fact, hang on here. Shane just decided that you're going to be our caller today who's going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. This is a free signed Unequal Protection sponsored by Stamps.com. And just tell Danielle Henry's on line 4. So, and he's on hold. So anyhow, right. Okay. Steve in Chesapeake, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
Hey,
thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
Sure, glad to. In reference to the gentleman you had on the phone earlier about his job being outsourced to China,
yeah,
I completely empathize with him. I've been through his shoes also, or been in his shoes.
Steve, I'm sorry, your phone is breaking up really, really bad, and I can't understand what you're saying. You want to try it one more time?
Okay, I said I empathize with the guy whose job is being outsourced to China.
Right.
The plant I used to work in closed down. I know what he's going through.
Oh, my.
But I think blaming... Can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
I think blaming Bain is the wrong person to blame or the wrong entity to blame.
I agree.
Sir?
I absolutely agree. You need to go back to the 1992 election when Bill Clinton, Ross Perot, and George Herbert Walker Bush all stood up on the stage, and Ross Perot said, if you guys sign this NAFTA thing, and if you sign this CAFTA-SHAFTA thing, and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, and create the WTO, and jump the United States into it, you are going to hear a giant sucking sound from the South. And
I remember that.
Yeah, and it wasn't just the South.
I voted for Ross Perot that election.
Yeah, and
go ahead. And currently... our government has the highest corporate tax rate in the world. it's hard for our businesses to compete.
No, I'm sorry, Steve. First of all, it's not true. We don't have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. We have one of the highest corporate tax rates in the developed world. That's of the 34 OECD countries. Secondly, we have what the second to the lowest actual what's called effective tax rate, actual collected corporate taxes of all those 34 countries. Second to the bottom. Because we have, there are so many loopholes that have been drilled in that tax code that you've got, you know, like ExxonMobil making billions in profits, paying not one penny. And then you and I pay for the military that protects their oil. General Electric pays not one penny, hasn't for years. I mean, on and on the list goes. Most companies in the United States, back when Eisenhower was president, about 34%, 35, 34, 35, I forget the number, it was one or the other, of the total revenue of the federal government came from corporate income taxes. Today it's less than 10%. We've got a problem. But, we're not, you know, we've got a bunch of freeloaders in this country, and they are billionaires, and they are corporations.
We do have a problem, and our government makes it hard on businesses to compete here. Just mentioned NAFTA and also some of the corporate tax rates of the developed world. It's hard to compete here.
Yeah, if the competition that you're talking about, if what you're suggesting is that we should go back to the system we had in place that George Washington put in place in 1793, 2 years after Alexander Hamilton proposed it in 1791 when he proposed his 11-point plan for manufacturing, and that became law in 1793 and stood until the election of 92, basically, although the Reagan administration, actually you could say it started with Nixon. Nixon really started kicking away at this stuff, and you saw our tariffs really start falling off in the 70s, in the late 60s, early 70s, with the Nixon administration. But from if you look at from the George Washington administration up until the Jack Kennedy administration, average tariffs on imported goods into the United States were a little over 30%. On average, you had to pay an additional 30% for anything that was imported, and that kept manufacturing in the United States. And now the average tariff on imported goods into the United States is a little under 2%. And
so our government needs to make it more competitive for our businesses to keep our jobs here.
But see, that language is used by Republicans. We need to get rid of regulations that inhibit and we need to make America more competitive. But they're the ones who are saying, "Oh, but don't you dare raise those tariffs on those transnational corporations."
Okay, well,
and the Democrats, by the way, about half the Democrats are in bed with them. But at least in the Democratic Party, you'll find people like Sherrod Brown who are just coming right out and saying, "We need to change. We need a rational trade policy." There is nobody in the Republican policy in the party who will say that.
Okay, I consider myself conservative, and I don't always agree with everything that Republicans do by a long shot. But we've got to make ourselves a lot more competitive.
Yeah.
Whatever avenue that is, we've got to do it.
I agree. I wrote a book about it called Rebooting the American Dream.
Bain capital on this guy losing his job, I think, is wrong. Because this company hired Bain to come make it leaner for them so they can make more money, the people, the executives of the company he worked for.
Okay, so would you agree with me, Steve?
Bain can't just come in there and take over and say, "We're doing this," without the consent of the executives running that company.
Would you agree with me that...
Do you agree with that?
I wouldn't altogether disagree with it. Would you agree with the statement that prohibition creates criminals?
Yes.
Okay. So then just like during the Al Capone days with alcohol, the heroin dealer down the street is there, you know, he's dealing heroin instead of, you know, working in a car plant, in part because we have our trade laws have done away with our car plants, but also in part because of the prohibition laws, right?
That's where I worked. I worked in a car plant that got closed down.
Yeah, okay. So
4 or 5 years ago.
Right. So then by following your logic, we shouldn't be blaming the heroin dealer. We should be blaming the legislators who made heroin illegal.
No, not necessarily.
Okay. That's so my point is that guy chose to deal heroin, and the Bain people chose to deal in human lives, and they're dealing in human suffering. And if they want to make a living doing that, yes, it's legal, and we should make it illegal. And it was illegal before the Reagan presidency. When Ronald Reagan came into office, before Reagan's term, before Reagan began, if you wanted to buy a company, you had to use your own money, or if you were going to borrow money, you had to be the person who put up the risk. And if that company went down, you lost your money. Reagan changed that, which is what made Bain possible. So now, after Reagan changed that and made it so that so that I could come to your company and I could say, okay, I'm going to buy your company for $100 million, and I'm going to, and then I'm going to, and I don't even have the money, And then I'm going to go to the bank, and I'm going to have the bank loan your company $100 million, and your company is going to pay that back. And to do that, they're going to have to cut your pay in half, you, Steve. And eventually, when that $100 million is paid back to the bank and the company is debt-free, I now own the company free and clear. I never put up a penny on it. I sell the company for the $100 million, and I make a $100 million profit. That's the business model of Bain Capital. It was a crime in the United States before 1982 to do that. When Reagan changed that law, that led to that mergers and acquisition mania. If you're old enough to remember the early 80s, the M&A artists, they called themselves, Michael Milken and all these guys, the lords of the universe, the captains, the masters of the universe, they called themselves. And a lot of them ended up going to jail, and their industry ended up changing its name to private equity from you know, takeover and LBOs.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm telling you, I own a URL. It all started with Reagan.com. It should be the title of my next book. My wife insists it's going to be on my tombstone.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
Yeah, it's time to catch up on what's going on in the world. A Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at Don Siegelman, that's IBefore ESIEGELMAN.org. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, live from Grenada. Ellen? Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I escaped here for a couple of days. Well, actually, you know, Shalene's Medical School, but I'm also on the board of their nonprofit, Windrus.
Oh, how great.
So, yeah, that's kind of cool. So, but a lot going on, and tomorrow I actually think you're going to hear from our staff who are out in Colorado, where I was going to go, but I decided that it's too close of a flight, so I'm not going to go to the debate. I am going to go to two of the debates, but we have at least three staff members at every debate. So we'll be bringing you lots of coverage. But what's really interesting in terms of debates is there was a study done in the great state of Ohio at Ohio State University, and they had people look at debate clips from 2004 and 2008. And then they had coverage. One which is sort of, let's view this as a football game, who's the winner and who's the loser, and one that was looking at issues. And then they asked the people to write a description of the debates. And what they saw post-debate from the press was really what influenced how they saw the debate.
So it's not who wins or it's not the performance of the debaters, it is the competence of the spinners and the what's the word for frivolous consideration of
the they see this as a, you know, win lose or whether they really see this as a serious discussion of issues and how the media that people consume afterwards influences their perception of the debate, not so much the debate itself.
Who did that study, Ellen?
It is done by a guy named Ray Pingree, and he's an assistant professor of communications at Ohio State.
I'm going to have to track that down. That sounds fascinating. It sounds, you know, makes perfect sense.
Of course it makes sense, yeah. Okay, speaking of debates, so last night there was a debate in Massachusetts.
Yes.
And of course it was Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren. And so Scott Brown just kept banging away at the fact that why wasn't she releasing her records and she got some special privilege and that she was claiming that she was Native American. And then, you know, a lot of people felt like he sort of came off as a bully.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. I have three Massachusetts individual stations I do, so I hear all kinds on this.
Mm-hmm.
But what was really fascinating is he has now released an ad post-debate that says she's not who you think she is, and it goes on this Native American thing. I mean, he's just gone mean.
Wow. She's not who you think she is, as in she's actually a Native American, look out, she's going to get you, or she's not a...
Well, she's not a Native American, and she's using this, and she's not true to who she really
but
is.
Nobody has yet disproven that her great-grandmother was part Native American, and nobody has proven it. And she just was going off the story that her mother and her father had told her. In fact, they had to elope because her maternal grandparents were so... upset, or her father's parents were so upset by the fact that her mother was part Native American that they didn't want him to marry her.
Right. And she says that she has not gotten any special privilege because of this. But Scott Brown, his ad, I'm telling you, was enough to make me pause. I mean, you ought to play this thing. It's quite unbelievable.
Huh.
And it, I've just never.
Is it going to help him or hurt him to do this?
I think that ad hurts him. And it was interesting because I said to one of my hosts in Massachusetts, I said, you know, you're running this ad, and he happens to be Republican, surprise, surprise. And I said, if I'm hearing this and I'm just down the middle, I'm just going to think he's going on her character, a woman's character. I'm not voting for this guy.
Well, and not only that, he's making it a racial issue.
Yes.
I mean, you're going to attack somebody on the basis of a racial issue on, you know, are you 164th African American or Native American or Asian American? You know, it's like, what? Seriously?
I know. It is really quite astounding.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so actually some of the Democrats were back in town today. They were having this steering and policy committee, and they're basically saying they really went after Governor Romney. They went after him on the Medicare issue. They talked about the Congressional Budget Office, and they talk about the Ryan Plan, and they really in front of the debates are really talking about the economic issues and Romney. So again, they don't usually get into town, but they are in town. And speaking of being in town, McCain fired up his bus again, not calling it the Straight Talk Express, but meeting with veterans groups for Romney. Hmm. And he went to 4 Florida cities today.
Wow. So John McCain still polls. I suppose in Republican circles, he's still respected, as long as Sarah Palin's not standing beside him.
Kerry has actually been the stand-in for Mitt Romney in the debates. Of course, he's had experience with President Obama. President Obama's been in Las Vegas. Governor Romney has been in Colorado, where none other than Ron Portman, I can't believe they couldn't find somebody better than Rob Portman, was the stand-in for Obama.
Yeah, and I guess Rob Portman has been playing that role for some time with Mr. Romney.
Yes.
Yeah.
That has been very much what he has done, which leads me to think that he's going to maybe get some, if there was a Romney administration, which there won't be, something out of it.
He would get a cabinet-level position or something.
Yeah. Elizabeth Warren, as you know, was up for that Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and today at the bureau that the Republicans did not want to have teeth ordered the American Express to refund $85 million to 250,000 customers. They found that the credit card company violated consumer protection laws at every stage of the process, from marketing to enrollment to payment to debt.
Wow. Wow. So the agency that that Elizabeth Warren created is actually helping people saving the money. That's got to help her.
Got it. I think so. If I were her, I'd use that.
Yeah, there you go. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen. And don't forget to check out donsiegelman.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Staples. You're going to hear a lot about staples. I'm not talking about the little metal contraptions that hold paper together. I'm talking about the office supply company. My prediction for tomorrow is that at least once Mitt Romney's going to figure out a way to work into his debate the fact that he was an early investor in Staples. Now, first of all, Bain was a minority investor in Staples. They were one of 8 major investors in Staples. Secondly, most of Bain's business model was not investment, you know, just pure investment, the way that they did with Staples. But third, and I think this is the most important part, the business model that Staples uses, in my opinion, represents the cancer stage of capitalism. It's also what Mitt Romney claims is one of his biggest accomplishments at Bain Capital. And as I said, you can expect to hear him talk about it during the debate. So what exactly did Romney accomplish at Bain Capital by investing in and growing Staples? Well, frankly, it produced the destruction of one slice of the American economy. Consider this. Economies are actually complex ecosystems with lots of interdependent players and basic rules. In nature, a wide range of players is called biodiversity, maintained by varying ecosystems like the Arctic and jungles and plains and oceans and all that kind of stuff. Nature's ecosystem is also maintained by evolution, creating predator, prey, and other symbiotic relationships. And the rules that govern nature's ecosystems are the rules of physics and biology. When the rules are distorted by things like us cutting down rainforests and turning them into single-crop farmland, biodiversity crashes, and eventually the ecosystem turns to desert. At the level of a single animal or person, when the natural interplay of various organs and parts of the body is overcome by a single line of cells rising up and taking over all the resources of the body, we have a word for that. We call it cancer. So to economies. In economies, the rules of the economic ecosystem are created by governments, and diversity is created by laws that prevent companies from becoming cancer-sized. We also put into place rules to prevent industries from being dominated by a small handful of companies that create the economic equivalent of replacing a highly diverse forest with 1 million acres of corn that will eventually become desert or dust bowl. So back to Staples. When one company is able to become so big and destroy all of its competitors and the economic diversity, it too becomes a form of cancer, an economic cancer. And we as a nation have known this for a long time. I mean, we understood this about business for a century, which is why Senator John Sherman, a Republican from Ohio, introduced the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890, which says every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize or combine or conspire with any other person or persons to monopolize any part of the trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations shall be deemed guilty of a felony. It's the Sherman Antitrust Act. Still on the books. The point of that law was to keep small businesses alive and prevent any company or small handful of companies from becoming economic cancers or producing economic deserts or dust bowls. We also prevented the worst kind of business predation by saying that if you wanted to buy a business, you had to do it with your own money. Or if you borrowed money, you were the one responsible for paying it back, whether the business succeeded or failed. Those laws worked out pretty well in the century from Senator Sherman's time until the 1980s. And then Ronald Reagan blew it all up with Reaganomics. Reagan oversaw the end to laws regulating mergers and acquisitions, and that not only led to the M&A mania of the 1980s, but also paved the way for Mitt Romney, Staples, and the destruction of the American middle class. At Bain, Romney made money not by borrowing money himself, but by dumping the debt from the purchase of a company onto that company itself. This let private equity vulture capitalists like Romney win whether the company survived or died. If the company survived, it paid back the debt and Bain made money, piles of money. If the company went bankrupt, the debt went into bankruptcy with it and Bain made money on the fees that they charged every step along the way. None of their money was at risk. Meanwhile, with Reagan stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Act, big companies started wiping out their smaller competitors. We saw it happen with restaurants, hotels, department stores, gas stations, and then they went after the local office supply store and stationery store. Soon Staples had put hundreds of these small mom-and-pop local stores out of business and replaced them with giant big stores that sell products made in low-wage countries and pay their store employees, all non-unionized, by the way, just above minimum wage. This is what Mitt Romney accomplished with Staples. He destroyed thousands of small family businesses and replaced them with, do you want fries with that? Wages. And today, as Dave Johnson over at Truthout, truthout.org, he's got a great piece on this topic. He writes, average Staples salaries for job postings nationwide are 51% lower than average salaries for all job postings. The pay at Staples appears to be around $8 to $10 an hour, $16,000 to $20,000 a year, certainly not enough to support a family or even pay rent in many areas, never mind buying food, end of quote. This destruction of local mom-and-pop shops and the herding of previously well-paid workers into low-wage jobs at massive transnational corporations, this represents what I call the cancer stage of capitalism. And its standard-bearer, its face, its king, is Mitt Romney. He used these new rules for mergers and acquisitions that Reagan gave him to become a half-billionaire. He invested in big box giant Staples, which has wiped out large parts of the American small business landscape. And he'll probably brag about Staples in the debate Wednesday as though he had accomplished something, as though his success at Staples somehow qualifies him to be president of the United States. And you know what? Staples should be a part of the debate. It should be included in the question, do we want cancer-style capitalism? Do we want to continue to be a nation where all of our small local businesses that pay well and are involved in and committed to the community, that they're replaced by big box outfits that pay crap wages, buy their products from low-wage countries, and funnel all their profits to a small handful of rich guy investors like Romney? And do we then want those rich guy investors to pay less than half the income tax rate, the federal income tax rate, of working people after they did so much damage to our economy? I mean, seriously. Let's talk about some real issues in the presidential debates. Issues that have to do with the survival of the American middle class and our economic ecosystem. Now, given the state of our media, I'm not holding my breath. But maybe, if enough of you let the media know you'd like to hear a real debate on Reaganomics, the damage it's done, and how Romney both profited from it and wants to double down on it, maybe, just maybe, we could have that conversation in America. It's a conversation that I've been calling for years. It's a conversation that I laid out in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. It's how do we reestablish a middle class? How do we undo the damage that Ronald Reagan did to this country when he stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and we became a nation of virtually every industry being dominated by fewer than a half dozen companies? We became a nation of monopolies. How do we undo the damage that happened during the Reagan administration when he crashed the top tax rate down to 28%, it's the 35% now, took it down from 74%, and thus pumping all this hot money into the economy, creating bubble after bubble after bubble? We always get bubble economies when the top tax rate is below 50%. How do we undo that damage? How do we undo the damage that was done, frankly, during the Clinton administration, signing NAFTA and GATT and the WTO? And that has been and pursued by, you know, with a vengeance by George W. Bush and now even Barack Obama signing these trade agreements. How do we undo that? Let's have that conversation. Let's have that debate. Somehow I doubt that's going to happen Wednesday night. And in fact, tomorrow we'll be talking about, you know, what should be on the topic. What would be interesting? I would love to have that debate. Let's hope.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, beyond let's hope, you know, you can contact the people who are putting on the debates and say, you know, I'd like to hear about this. How about our trade policies? Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Chris in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Chris, what's up?
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was initially motivated to call you today because I was driving home from work and heard you talking about Mitt Romney when he was bishop, and if there was a woman who said she wanted to divorce her husband, she was then basically thrown out of the church. I'm a Mormon and a progressive,
mm-hmm.
both.
Right.
I'm a convert to the church of more than 30 years. I grew up in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
I worked my first election when I was 10 years old for Jack Kennedy.
Good on you. If you're calling to defend Mormonism, I'm not attacking Mormonism.
I'm not defending Mormonism, Tom, but what I want to give you another perspective, because when I've heard you make some statements about Mormonism and what I know after being a member and serving in what's called leadership positions in the church, that you're misinformed.
Okay.
But and understand, too, that Not all Mormons come from Utah.
Right. I
not all Mormons are extreme right-wing conservatives.
I know that.
That we all come from a varied background.
Yeah.
The church is now the majority of the members of the church are outside North America.
Mm-hmm.
So we are a varied group of people, and I just want you to kind of keep that in mind.
Sure.
You know, the other thing is this, that last week Harry Reid said,
who is a Mormon?
Mitt is not the face of Mormonism.
Right.
Remember that.
Okay.
Okay, when you think of the church.
You've got it. Chris, the point that I was trying to make, and I was trying to have a debate with a guy who was going to tell us that we should all be afraid of the Muslims because they're going to try and impose Sharia law on America. And my point was that me as a Christian or you as a Mormon, you may call yourself a Christian, whatever, somebody is a Catholic, me as a Protestant, let's say, somebody as a Jew, somebody as a Hindu, all of us have wackadoodle beliefs, right? I can give you a list of things that I actually believe and practice that make no sense to me, but it feels good to me, or it seems like, okay, this is how I was raised. And I think that that's true of all of us. And we should all have the right to practice our own religions or our lack of religions, too, in the way that we choose to, and not have somebody come along and say, we've got to pass a law against this religion having its people practice their own particular, you know, form of what, you know, in this case, in the case of Islam, it was Sharia law. But, you know, the comparison that I was making is, you know, Mitt Romney running around with his magic underwear is not that different than the Muslim who has to wear a beard. I mean, you know, these are the basic rules, right?
Well, except that here's what I want you to kind of expand your perspective on.
Well, I was picking on Catholics, too.
What you call magic underwear, to me, is something sacred that reminds me of a covenant.
You're right. It's sacramental clothing, just like a tzitzit, just like the undershirt that Orthodox Jews wear with the
exactly.
Yes,
and
I understand.
All of that deserves respect. And in fact, it's those of us on this side of the political spectrum that have always given that out.
Yeah.
Right?
Let me suggest that
it's the right wing that demands an isthmus test, a litmus test.
Yeah. It arguably it deserves respect. But if it can't withstand ridicule, then it's got a problem.
No, and you know what? I'm not saying that either. But what I'm saying is, first, you know, inform yourself as much as you can, number one. Number two, understand that Mitt Romney is not the face of the church of Massachusetts, or Michigan, where he grew up.
Right.
But also consider that as you make comments about this, these are things that people do hold sacred, and they deserve respect. And that's really all that I'm asking for.
Okay. All right. Chris, I respect your personal commitment to your religion. I honor that, and I respect that. I will not say that I respect any particular religion, but I respect the practice of the religion. Does that make sense?
Exactly, sure, because we don't have to, the point is, we don't have to agree on that.
Right.
And particularly on this side of the political spectrum, we agree on more than we disagree on.
Yes, okay, well said. Thank you very much, Chris, for the call.
All right,
yeah, appreciate
thanks,
it.
Tom.
Thank you. Cora in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, Cora, what's up?
Well, if I have to show my really grody photo on my, you know, driver's license every time I vote,
right,
I think I should demand that every time somebody buys a handgun or a rifle, et cetera, they need to show their photo ID, and it needs to be registered in their name, even if they buy it from the next door neighbor. Because, I mean, if you bought a used vehicle from your next door neighbor, they should provide you with a bill of sale and a title
right,
in order for you to register it.
Right.
So, you know, even if people say this is, you know, hurting the law-abiding citizen who owns guns, I would say you're hurting the law-abiding citizen who's just trying to vote.
Yeah, I think that we're mixing apples and oranges, but your point, if your point is that we're responding with hysteria and overreaction
right,
to, you know, one guy down in Florida from Austria who apparently voted for George W. Bush and was not a U.S. citizen, the one guy that Rick Scott has found so far, if, you know, by knocking 80,000 people off the voting rolls, And we're not responding to the fact that we've had 12 mass shootings now in the United States in the last couple of years. And, you know, in most cases, they have been guns bought, you know, legally, but, you know, in some cases, actually, I don't know the details of this. I shouldn't say in most cases, but I know it's certainly in some cases at gun shows where there's no registration and we have no way of tracking these people. That,
I mean,
you know,
it's like we're trying to pin each other down.
Right.
With all this massive inertia. And it's like Chris, you know, saying Romney is not the face of Mormonism. Well, you can say the same thing about the Muslims who are protesting and doing the evil deeds they're doing.
Yeah,
they are
the
not
good
the
deeds
whole face of the Muslim people.
Yeah, excellent point. Excellent point. Thank you, Cora, for the call. I'm still scratching my head on the notion that all religions deserve to be respected. I will again say I respect the practice of religion. But religion itself?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That's a tough one. That's an interesting one, actually. And I think that was the debate that the founders had at the beginning of this country. The bad and the very, very raucously ugly. I don't know how to say that word. I'll just tell you. The good. Chris Clue. Clue is the punter for the Minnesota Vikings NFL team. And recently he came out in strong support of gay marriage or gay marriage equality. However, not everyone was happy about his endorsement. Minnesota State Representative Mary Franson, a Republican, called out Clue for attacking traditional marriage and suggesting that homosexuality is not normal behavior. Or she says, boy, that sentence is badly constructed. My apologies. In response to Franson's comments, Clue doubled down on his support of marriage equality and even offered to formally debate Franson on the issues. Kudos to Chris for standing up for the rights of millions of Americans. The bad. Congressman Todd Akin. Akin should try being nice to women voters, especially considering his controversial and inflammatory legitimate rape comments over the summer. But apparently he hasn't gotten the message, and he's still going after women. Akin was asked at a town hall meeting why he voted against the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which makes it easier for women to challenge unequal pay. Akin told the crowd, "I believe in free enterprise. I don't think the government should be telling people what you pay and what you don't pay." Or, in other words, Congressman Akin believes in discrimination. I don't think those comments are going to help him in November. And the very, very ugly Sam Zell. Zell, a corporate businessman worth only $4 billion, was on CNBC this morning. In an interview with CNBC's Andrew Ross Sorkin, Zell argued that government benefits are disincentivizing struggling Americans from wanting to be successful. Basically, Zell furthered the conservative notion that Americans who receive welfare are lazy and unmotivated. In Zell's mind, a middle-class American who got laid off because his or her job was outsourced to China now has to take unemployment is lazy. If corporate tycoons like Zell weren't running roughshod over the economy at the expense of the middle class, Americans wouldn't have to be relying so heavily on government benefits in the first place. Calling honest and hardworking Americans who are just trying to survive lazy is very, very ugly. Not only that, Zell gets hundreds of millions of dollars in government benefits, probably billions of dollars in government benefits. There's no billionaire who doesn't. I mean, come on, give me a break. Amazing. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, the layoffs of the Sensata workers, those people should be compensated by Mitt Romney. He's, after all, taking away their livelihood, and you know he's not being really held accountable for that. And I think when you know these vulture capitalists do this kind of procedure, they cause a great amount of harm to the people themselves and to that community. It's in northwestern Illinois. I think it has a high rate of unemployment.
Yes.
He's succeeded in making it that much higher. And I think he can well afford to compensate and retrain all the people that he's laying off. I didn't hear anything from him about that.
Yeah.
He's a big believer in private charity as opposed to government, welfare and this sort of thing. So I haven't heard that from him, and I think we need to hold him accountable for that. I'd like to ask that question.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, that's a good one. John, thank you very much for the call. I agree. Paul in Northville, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great. What's on your mind?
I want to respond to that guy a little bit who kept repeating the Republican talking point that we need to become more competitive.
Right.
I mean,
he didn't understand what it meant.
What's that?
He didn't understand what it meant. He didn't have any meaning to associate with that. I tried to associate trade policy with it, and he agreed with me on that. So I don't think that he really understood what the Republicans were saying, because what they're saying is you need to take lower wages.
Exactly. What they're saying is to become more competitive with China, we all need to work for 50 cents an hour.
Right. It's not just China. China, by the way, has seen wages rise. China is rapidly industrializing. Now it's, are you going to compete with Burma? Are you going to compete with North Korea? Are you going to compete with, Vietnam, rural Vietnam? Those, are you going to compete with, some of the countries in South and Central America, or some of those regions, Colombia, for example, where trade unionists are regularly, it's the most dangerous place on earth to be a trade unionist. They're regularly murdered.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, we need to protect our jobs, not our companies and Mitt Romney, who's shipping our jobs overseas. We need to protect our jobs, not those people.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Beth in Detroit. Hey, Beth, what's up?
I wanted to commiserate with the gentleman that called a while ago who was going for unemployment for the first time in 33 years. I was a Detroit public school teacher. I no longer have a job because in 2011, our governor got rid of tenure. Mm-hmm. And don't you know, all of a sudden, after 33 and a half years of working, having stellar evaluations, I'm evaluated ineligible and told I can no longer teach. So I have just joined the ranks of the unemployed and went for unemployment the first time in 33 and a half years.
Wow.
So he's not alone.
Beth, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm guessing that because you had been teaching for all those decades, that your pay was higher than somebody fresh out of college, and the governor of Michigan is doing is trying to replace the high-wage workers with low-wage workers.
Oh, obviously. They had they also brought an emergency financial manager so they could say that all this was okay by changing our contract. But they had a job fair down south that none of us were allowed to attend to hire all these new teachers.
You were not allowed to attend?
We were not allowed to attend.
How do they keep you out?
We were not told about it, and we found out after the fact that they had gone down south to hire all these first-year teachers to take our jobs.
Down south? You mean Southern Michigan?
No, down south, like in the southern states.
Like in Mississippi. They're going to Alabama to get teachers for Detroit because they're laying off the Detroit teachers in Detroit.
Yes, I'm a highly qualified Detroit teacher who was there because I love my children. I wasn't there for the money, believe me. If I was teaching for the money, then I'm really stupid. I did it because I love my job, and now they've kicked me out 2.5 years before my retirement, and the governor has stolen thousands of dollars from my pension that I somehow now have to survive.
That's amazing, and particularly when you consider that teachers in the United States, you have to have a college degree to be a teacher, plus continuing education and further education beyond that. When you compare teaching salaries in the United States to other professions, the average of all professions that require a college degree, teachers make more than 20% less than the average college degree required and annual maintenance educated person. And then they're going to try and take it out on teachers. This is terrible. Thank you for sharing your story, Beth. I'm very sorry to hear it, and I wish you the very best. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
And you too. Joel in Snyderville, Utah. Hey, Joel, what's up?
Not too much. How you doing today?
Great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Things have been pretty good for me. But here, your point about how we need to bring back the middle class in this country. As an engineer who's actively, lack of a better term, I've killed jobs. I don't know how else to put it, but mm-hmm. with the American industry, specifically manufacturing, becoming more and more automated. The idea that we need the union guy out of high school running the hydraulic press is outdated, and it just can't happen anymore. I'm not being political about it. I'm just saying the industry has changed radically in the last 50 years.
Oh, I don't disagree. You know who Eli Whitney was, don't you?
He invented the cotton gin.
Right. And the
it actually led to slavery extending about another 30 or 40 years.
Well, there are some who suggest
was
that
decreasing until the cotton gin came in.
Yeah, there are some who suggest that the cotton gin actually led to the end of slavery, because the cotton gin could do the same work that 50 slaves could do, one cotton gin. And so, you know, there was less need for slaves, and that was disruptive to society. But I think that the important point that you're missing, and you know, please feel free to challenge me on this, is that Time Magazine did a cover story on this, either Time or Life, in like 1964, 65, something like this, about automation and how automation was making life better. And they went back to the mid to the late 19th century and just carried the statistics forward. And they found that, you know, in the late 19th century, people worked on average 70 to 80 hours a week. And in the early 20th century, it was down to around 65 hours a week. By the 1930s, it was a 60-hour week. By the 1940s, it was the 50-hour week. And then by the 1960s, it was the 40-hour week. And they were saying, you know, if productivity – and this was all the consequence of what you're doing, engineers making things more efficient, making the equipment more efficient. And so what they said let me just finish this thought. What they said was that if you extend this out to the year 2000, by the year 2000, the average person will be taking home the same salary they are now, but instead of working a 40-hour week, they'll be working a 23-hour week. And in fact, if you were to take the productivity line, now retrospectively, looking back at this, productivity has continued to increase, and automation has been a big piece of that. If you were to take that productivity line and line it up with, instead of wages, with hours, that's true. But what has happened is that the money that would have been paid to people working a 22-hour week or 23-hour week instead of a 40-hour week, instead of going to the workers, instead of workers having fewer hours and therefore more people employed at the same wage, that money has gone to the top to the CEO class. You know, 275% increase in their wages over that period of time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So it's not a matter of automation. Automation could make us all members of the leisure class if we wanted. It's a matter of who's ripping off the money.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Indeed, you tell him, Leonard. Stuart in Chicago. Hey, Stuart, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I think the word respect is getting mixed up with forbearance in your listener's mind.
Perfect.
If not yours, I don't know.
Yes.
I can see perfectly.
You're talking about with regard to religion.
Yeah. We should forbear to interfere with the practice of a religion if it obeys laws. But I have no respect for it as a practicing atheist, if you want that silly term. I have no respect for religion or for particular religions.
Right.
But I certainly, absolutely would not try to interfere with them.
Right. Okay. And I think that you have captured very well the grammar or vocabulary struggle that I had, and thank you for forbearance, because you know there are a lot of religions that I can't respect that I think are just kind of crazy, but including some pieces of my own. But I would never want to say to somebody, you should not practice that religion. You know, if you find value in that, whether the religion is atheism, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, or, you know, being a Methodist. I mean, it's like, you know, do what you want to do.
Yeah.
Forbearance.
Like
perfect.
Rock music, I hate it, but you have a perfect right to like it and to practice it.
Yeah, there you go. Well said. Thank you very much, Stuart, for that. I appreciate it. Steve in Monroe, Ohio. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to address Tom Akin's argument Todd Aikman.
Todd Aikman.
Which appears to be bigotry, but it disguises itself in Ayn Rand's False Dilemma.
Okay, let me hang on just a second. Let me set this up for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about. Todd Aikman, who famously talked about how women who got legitimately raped would not get pregnant because their bodies would reject this, now has come out and said that he doesn't support the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, that he doesn't support federal legislation that requires that women be paid the same as men, because he thinks that the right to contract is a private contract, is a private right, and that employers and employees should work out whatever they work out. In other words, as an employer, I should be able to, for example, or any employer, Mitt Romney, you, Steve, whoever, should be able to discriminate based on gender. And, you know, the obvious next step is, okay, then if that's okay, then do we discriminate based on religion or on race or on national origin or, on age or, you know, and on it goes. And he was basically arguing in favor of discriminating based on gender. So now back to you, Steve.
Thank you. Everything that I hear coming out of Republicans' mouths seems to imply this false dilemma that we have to choose between only two ideologies, one which is based solely and absolutely on individual liberty, and one which is based solely and absolutely on the good of society. And whichever one you choose, in their estimation, automatically makes you the enemy of the other. And this is their Achilles heel. This is what we need to call them out on. They are constantly getting away with it in all of their rhetoric. And Todd Aikman is trying to disguise his bigotry with Ayn Rand's False Dilemma, that the individual is the beginning and end of all political ethical dilemmas.
Right. That's a brilliant analysis of it. The false dichotomy, the false dilemma. Yeah. And it is, you're absolutely right. And they don't account for the gray area. Although sometimes you'll get a libertarian and say, well, I do acknowledge that we need an army and a police force. And then you say, well, you know, and then we can just start that argument. Okay, oh, you acknowledge the need for a commons? Well, no, not really. And
yeah, the good of the individual is included in the good of the society, and a good society requires individual liberty.
Right, Ayn Rand famously, notoriously, aggressively, and repeatedly said there is no such thing as society. There is no aggregation. All there is a large lump or a large number of individuals acting in their own self-interest. There is no such thing as society. And in that, she was horribly, horribly wrong.
And if that is true, then there's no such thing as cities. It's just a collection of buildings.
Right.
There's no such thing as human beings. It's just a collection of cells. There's no such thing as a military. It's just a bunch of enlistees.
Right. Brilliantly
so.
On. Yeah. There's no such thing as the United States of America. It's just a bunch of states. It's just a bunch of towns. It's just a bunch of buildings. Well, buildings, actually, to take it right down. It's a bunch of atoms, Steve. It's just a bunch of atoms.
Also have subdivisions.
No such thing as molecules, right? But your analysis is perfect. It's absolutely perfect, and I will have to use a variation of it. With your permission, the next time I debate a libertarian?
Please.
Let's go
at them.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks a lot for the call. How much time do we have? A little over a minute. Great. We can get another phone call in here. Miguel in Gilroy, California. Hey, Miguel, got a minute to the break. What's up? Or to the end of the show, actually.
Hello, Tom. We were listening earlier that you mentioned about the capitalist cancer. And, very fast. This cancer in Mexico, we know it as NAFTA, the Free Trade Agreement, which killed the independent farming industry. And since the 90s, this has increased the illegal immigrants to the United States.
Sure.
This policy was signed by Clinton, and it not only Mexico, but South America also. And the second comment was about the electoral voting cards. This has existed in Mexico also from the beginning of the 90s, but took several years to implement, not months before an election.
Right.
The cards are very effective, but they are also prone to electronic manipulation.
Sure.
So this was just the comment.
Yeah, and if somebody is going to try to commit election fraud or voter fraud, ID is not going to change anything. I mean, you can get phony ID. I mean, look at how many people who are under 18 or under 21 show up in bars to drink, right? You tell me phony ID doesn't exist? Miguel, thank you very much for the call. Well said. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, the first debate between President Obama and the GOP challenger Mitt Romney is tomorrow night. We'll be taking a close look at what to expect, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, occupy something. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.